Hello, I'm Martin Wall, and this is the Climate Diplomacy Podcast. This week, I attended a planetary security conference in The Hague. The Planetary Security Conference is the world's premier climate security gathering. This year, it brought together policymakers, academics, military personnel, and NGOs to understand and address the security risks of climate change. With a hashtag doable, the conference followed hot on the heels of the Munich Security Conference, where climate change emerged as one of the big themes. At the conference, I spoke to some of the experts on the subject, but before that, I spoke with Adelphi Managing Director Alexander Karius about his expectations for the week. So I'm here with Alexander Karius, Managing Director of Adelphi, at the beginning of the conference on Tuesday morning. So Alexander, how did this conference come about, and what do you think can be achieved here over the next couple of days?
Good morning, Martin. I think, first of all, this is the fourth conference of the Planetary Security Initiative on the subject. And the good thing that it obviously established itself as the place to be for everybody who works on the geopolitics of climate change. What I notice is that there's an increasing number of government representatives joining that. So it's the place to exchange ideas among researchers, practitioners, and government representatives on all sorts of climate and security issues. And what I hope that this conference is going to achieve is a closer look on particularly how we look at the global climate risks in the very specific communities of defense and development and climate policy.
Okay, that's a good preview. Let's see what it turns out like.
I'm here with Nazri Jayaram, who is an assistant professor in the Manipal Academy of Higher Education in India. So, Nazri, you've blogged recently on the Climate Diplomacy website about the connection between climate and migration, and what and the evidence for that is becoming stronger. What do you think about this area?
So climate and migration, the connections between the two, the linkages between the two has always been sort of contested. So although we have a lot of studies which try to link the two, including in the context of the Arab Spring, the Syrian conflict, or even before that, whether it's internal displacement or intrastate migration, like cross-border migration. But to link it to climate change directly was always a problem. And we have had a lot of media reports, but again, that has also been not so well acknowledged or accepted widely in the academic or research world, and therefore not even the policy world, of course. You see large waves of migration all across the world, but to link it to climate change has always been a trouble. But I see that the blog that I wrote for Climate Diplomacy website, there have been a few studies in the past, like especially the recent ones, in which the links are being actually explored much further. They're being quantified, and they're not being blown out of proportion. And that's very important in how climate migration is framed. The more you say millions and billions of people are moving because of climate change, it kind of dilutes the whole debate to a large extent. And I think we are moving away from that kind of determinism or causal linkages, and to a large extent even correlations, because I think it's easier to correlate climate change to migration than, say, establish the causal linkages. But we are slowly moving towards more and more causal linkages, and that's very important. So I'm kind of optimistic that there will be more action on this in the future, but it's moving at a rather slower pace than one would want it to be. Yeah.
So what type of action do you think would be relevant in this context?
Yeah, so in terms of action, what I feel is that, you know, to have like an international mechanism on climate and migration is going to be very difficult, because these are very context-specific solutions that we are looking at. So I think we need to develop more national mechanisms to deal with or mainstreaming climate change into policies that deal with migration or refugee issues and so on. At the same time, we also have to have regional sort of mechanisms. I think that will be more effective in tackling something like climate migration. Like I said, some are more sensitive than others in dealing with say a topic like climate migration, and like I come from India, and if you say that people from Bangladesh are, you know, the migrants from Bangladesh are moving to India because of climate change, there will be, I mean, this is not something that is accepted or acknowledged. So you need to frame it in a such a way that it's kind of acceptable to the region and the countries that are involved in this whole issue, and therefore, I mean, it becomes more complicated if it's like a conflict scenario. Yes. So yeah, so that's what I would like to say. Yeah.
Okay, and very quickly, what does doable in the context of this conference mean to you?
In terms of doable, it's interesting that the conference has chosen this hashtag, and we are talking about more doable things than what are more normative in nature. It's important that, like, even when we talk in the context of climate and migration, if you're talking about an institutional home at the UN that deals with this, it's kind of like a far-fetched kind of a thing. So it's important that we stick to the things that are more practical in nature. We adopt result-oriented approaches that can give us very tangible results. And I think the hashtag doable is very important in this context. It's very interesting as to how you know, how stakeholders that are involved in climate and security debates are not, like, you know, living in this abstract world trying to reach normative kind of solutions, rather to come to the ground, to study what's happening on the ground, and to do what is necessary to tackle a situation from spiraling into a crisis. Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
And that was Dinazri Jayaram, an assistant professor in the Manipal Academy in India. Next, I spoke with Camilla Bourne, a senior policy advisor with E3G in the UK and a CIPRI senior fellow. Camilla is co-author of a report called From Threat Multiplier to Peace Contributor.
Camilla, what is the security case for adaptation?
So adaptation is something that's going to become a norm for all of us because the climate's changing and we're going to have to think about it in whatever we do, whatever we care about, be that public health, be that food, be that enjoying the landscape that we enjoy in our time off at the weekend. But it is also going to become a problem for the security space because it is disrupting livelihoods, it's disrupting food, it is shaping some of the huge conflict risks we have. For example, mass youth unemployment often leads to fragile situations which could lead to conflict. And that means that we have to think strategically about how we contain and manage climate-related risks because they have this really nasty tendency to combine with other risks to really create dangerous situations. Adaptation requires long-term thinking. It requires medium to long-term investments. It's political, it's social, it's challenging, and we need to be working on that to build the kind of governance structures and opportunities which promote peace. Adaptation is one of those tools. It has to connect with those other risks, but it is a really important part of how we move forward in managing climate risks.
So, in the report, you mentioned certain risks like interstate risks, the melting of the Arctic, displacement and migration. Could you speak a little bit about some of those risks?
Yeah, so I spoke about some of the risks before regarding youth unemployment and other elements and livelihoods. I think we have other broader geopolitical risks. I mean, the risks around energy transition, the risks around destabilization of cultures and cultural types of the way that we do things will disrupt and can cause displacement, can cause lack of resources in certain places, and that can then cause tensions between countries who maybe do have those resources, and you start seeing those state tensions. With something like the Arctic, I think it's terrifying that we have very little understanding of how we would respond to climate tipping points, and arguably the science is showing us that we're very close, or if not possibly even breaching those. Those will have massive implications on the weather, on sea level rise all over the world, and we haven't considered what are the cascade effects on that. How do we manage that? How do we contain that? And how do we stop that spilling over into other social and political challenges which could spark conflict and could cause challenge and tension?
So in the report, you outlined some principles to address emerging climate-related security risks. Could you mention some of those to us?
Yeah, so in the report we talk about the need for adaptation to be political, you need to think about where you want to do it. You need to think about who you want to do it with. Often when it comes to adaptation, it's not about immediately putting in some infrastructure that's going to manage waters, not putting in a dam, not putting in a a flood defense. But it will be about working with the community to understand, okay, we're going to be in a context where we're going to have less water. Who are the power brokers that need to build the cultural confidence for that community to have that situation? Who are the mediators that need to talk between two or more countries across a river basin who need to think about how they're going to manage their water together? So it's not just about the infrastructure, which can be the sort of, oh, this will be the easy way to do it. But what we see is, generally speaking, adaptation often leads to maladaptation. We're locking in wrong practice, which is actually sparking more risks, more of those interconnected risks and those nasty outcomes that we're trying to avoid. So we know that we need to do this political process to understand what's culturally and politically relevant for that geography. We also know that we need to be timely. So adaptation and doing it properly, doing political processes, it takes time. You cannot just chuck in something and hope it's a sticking plaster. You have to do that whole process of engagement. You have to do that process of development, that cultural and social understanding. So you have to start now, be planning out the medium term. So it's trying to move beyond just thinking, okay, we can just do growth, we can just do development in that kind of very normative way, and just chuck in some infrastructure and that will solve people's problems, to we have to think about this as a systems-wide challenge, and we have to recognize the political challenges in it, because that is really where a lot of the conflict risks really lie.
Thanks, Camilla.
It's Friday afternoon. We've returned from the Planetary Security Conference, and I'm here again with Alexander Karius. So, Alexander, do you have some reflections on the conference? Did it meet your expectations?
Yes, it did. Two observations from my side. First of all, I mean, at the beginning of the conference, we presented progress towards the implementation of the Hague Declaration. And when it was launched in December 2017, we said that we need to track progress. And we would like to encourage the more than 100 signatories in order to design and implement programs. It's much too early, really, to talk about implementation, but it's interesting that there were a series of programs launched specifically in responding to the Hague Declaration. The two things that we need to mention is the setup of a so-called institutional home within the UN system, the mechanism that has been built in UNDPPA, UNEP, and UNDP in order to increase the capacities to respond to the very specific information required by the Security Council to better understand the very complex interlinkages between climate and security. As the hashtag is doable, I hope that in the years to come, we can report back on what we are doing, and that in a couple of years from now, we can also Twitter the news on and success stories under the hashtag done. My second observation is that at this conference, there was a strong presence from the military sector, from the defense sector, particularly from the Netherlands. And I think that is a good sign. What was interesting is that more or less at the same time when we had the conference in The Hague is that President Trump announced a new presidential commission on climate security, where, that's my interpretation, he tries to find a counter-argument to the very strong arguments by the defense community by setting up this commission and putting a climate denier, a well-known climate denying scientist
in William Happer
to basically develop and counter argument to what the defense community was pushing for. I'm curious to see how that is playing out, but it's very typical for the U.S. government, and at that point under this leadership, is to basically disqualify climate science and disrespect evidence that is given, and very strong also strategic interest in the subject. The second observation, and I think Laurence Tubiana made that clear in the final concluding panel, is that it is time to rethink the way we do climate policy since the Paris Agreement in December 2015, because the climate security discourse is very much relying on this very alarmistic argument of we are reaching the tipping points, and if we do not continue increasing the level of ambition on climate policy, it's too late. And if you repeat that for 10 to 15 years, that it's 5 to 12, at one point you have to ask yourself what time it is. So is that 3 o'clock in the morning already, or is that 7 in the evening and there is still enough time to develop resilience strategies or to adapt to a dangerous climate world? And that has to do with rethinking the way we communicate and the way we try to embed climate policy measures in the larger context of social policy, structural policy, redistributional policies.
I think in the last 6 months in particular, there's been a lot more energy and a lot more momentum behind this climate movement, from the Global Climate Action Summit to the school strikes to the IPCC report on 1.5 degrees and even the Munich Security Conference, where it emerged as a high profile issue. So do you get that sense as well, that there's going to be a lot faster movement on climate action over the coming 1-2 years?
I think the most positive things about Greta Thunberg and the Friday school strikes is that a younger generation, I think two things. One is that it comes from a younger generation that rediscovers or discovers for themselves political protest as a means of engagement. That hasn't happened so much. And I mean, there are no large-scale protests on the streets anymore if you compare that to the 70s, for instance. So protest is coming back. That's a way of engagement. And the second thing that I find very interesting with this youth movement is that it's not so much, I think it has an impact on the climate discourse, because the climate discourse, apart from this very alarmistic repercussion, is that it was talking about future generations. And I think that's difficult. If you talk always about future generations, it neglects this generation. And now this generation is speaking up, a very young generation. So it bridges basically the idea of it has to happen now. So if Greta Thunberg makes an argument to say, okay, the result of the so-called coal commission or the infrastructure commission that is talking about stepping out of coal production in Germany until the year 2038, she made the argument that it's not fast enough. Whether that is well thought through, it's another thing. But she makes a very, very clear statement to say it has to happen now, and it has to happen fast, and it has to happen in a very substantial way. And I think that makes me very confident. So I'm positive on that side.
Okay, I think that's a good place to leave it. Thanks a million.
Okay, thanks.
This was the Climate Diplomacy Podcast with me, Martin Wall. I'd like to thank our speakers today, Danazri Jayaram, Alexander Karius, and Camilla Bourne. I would also like to thank the Irish Research Council and the European Commission for funding this podcast through their Caroline Fellowship. Until next time, goodbye.